This is Money Talks, and I'm glad you're with me on this Easter weekend. I'm very glad. We've got some great stuff planned for you. Special weekend? Well, let's bring you a special show. One of the things that we've got going is the number one cost of living for most Canadians, and that's taxes. So I've got Tim Cesnik joining us. Of course, the deadline countdown is on right now. I'm going to ask Tim, though, what are the changes that we have to be aware of? But maybe even more importantly, what are the things that people miss when they fill out their tax form that actually cost them money? Because if they had done it correctly, they would have saved money. Anyways, that's coming with Tim Cesnik. Also, I've got Mark Leibovit. One of the big questions I'm getting asked is, yeah, we were right about commodities. We were right about things like copper. Gold looks very interesting right now. Look at oil, those kinds of things. But is it too late to get involved? So I'm going to ask the former Timers Digest Timer of the Year, Gold Market Timer of the Year, is it too late? Is there still room to run? And you know what? I think you're going to be shocked by his answer. And speaking of shocked, I've got a shocking stat of the week that deals with, I think, one of the most important issues in personal finance. So you don't want to miss that. And a goofy award. How can I not feature President Joe Biden? They are so confused when it comes to energy. So stay with us. But first, 2 weeks after the federal budget in a country that's now hit $1.3 trillion in federal debt, in a rising interest rate environment, no less, we seem to have escaped with a modicum of serious analysis on the budget. Oh, I know. The immediate verdict in many corners was this was a modest budget, a prudent budget. Really, without going into a great deal of elaboration past, hey, we thought it could be worse, given the big money promises during the past federal election campaign by both the Liberal and NDP parties. You know, in the follow-up coverage, we heard how some individuals and groups were impacted in this monstrous 700-page extravaganza. But one area that consistently avoids scrutiny in the aftermath is how the money's actually spent. As history makes clear, the easy part is promising more spending, which obviously some politicians are pretty darn good at. That is then followed, many times not as often, by actually making good on the promise and spending the money. Then comes the most unpopular part, and that is measuring how effectively the money was spent. But it's not just politicians who aren't that interested in seeing how effectively our money's spent. I mean, clearly the public and the vast majority of the media don't clamor for it. I mean, you think that after decades of Auditor General's reports chronicling, I mean, shockingly high amounts of tax dollars wasted. I'll give you an example with the implementation of programs like the Phoenix Pay System, which then Auditor General Michael Ferguson called unfathomably incompetent. Or what about the billions lost on the gun registry? Or the recent report by the Auditor General on the $188 billion Invest Canada plan that was to be spent over 10 years, what current Auditor General Karen Hogan found that the lead department involved, the Department of Infrastructure Canada, was, in quotes, unable to provide meaningful public reporting on the plan's overall progress toward its expected results. Come on, how do you manage billion-dollar projects without timely information? Yet that's been a complaint of successive auditor generals, from Denny DeSotel to Sheila Fraser, Michael Ferguson, and now Karen Hogan. As Denny DeSotel famously asked in 2001, why do these problems seem so intractable? Why do they persist year after year, despite express commitment to set them right? End of quote. I mean, we're still waiting on an answer. But right through to Auditor General Karen Hogan's scathing report into Public Health Canada's handling of the pandemic. And she concluded that, in quotes, I'm discouraged that the Public Health Agency of Canada did not address longstanding issues, some of which were raised repeatedly for more than two decades, end of quote. Come on, repeatedly for two decades. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars. But what's changed is that we're not just talking about our own tax dollars now. Clearly, we're talking about our children and their children's tax dollars, given the amount of money that's been borrowed, certainly recently, and also projected in the next 5 years. I invite you to think about that, because I'm pretty puzzled by this. I don't know how it jives with the common claim that we care about our children and their well-being. I mean, don't give yourself a headache, because you actually can't get those two together. So let me bring to your attention one aspect of the federal budget that I'm willing to bet didn't occur to anyone covering it. The budget earmarks an additional $1.2 billion over the next 5 years to go to Revenue Canada to expand its audits of what they say larger entities and non-residents engaged in aggressive tax planning. Well, they want to increase the investigation and prosecution of criminal tax evasion. Well, who doesn't want that? I mean, we want to catch tax cheats. We want them to pay their taxes and their penalties. And it's not the first time this has surfaced. I mean, it's a political winner to at least to talk about it. but is it a financial winner for Canadians? Interesting. Just a week or so ago, the Parliamentary Budget Office recently issued a report on the effectiveness of the Canada Revenue Agency, which concludes that while it's one of the most expensive in the developed world, it's way below the international average in terms of collections and expenses. As Parliamentary Budget Officer Yves Giraud states, for every dollar of operating expenses, Canada collects $74 in net tax revenue. That was in 2019, the latest numbers, and $72 it was in 2018. So again, $74 in 2019, $72 the year before. But the international average is $126. He goes on to say that the CRA, in quotes, collects $100 in 2019 and $98 in 2018 for every dollar spent on wages. Again, we're well below the international average of $190 collected. I mean, certainly a performance to consider before more money is spent on the CRA. So quickly, last thing, I have a suggestion. If finding money is the goal for government, I find it interesting that no one in politics, and I'm not aware of anyone in the media, that suggested that instead of giving $1.2 billion to Revenue Canada over the next 5 years, before anyone has actually bothered to ascertain why we're so below international average in terms of money collected for the money spent, why not instead give that money to the Auditor General's office? Especially given they've had no problem identifying huge amounts of tax dollars that are not efficiently and effectively spent. I mean, come on, successive Auditor Generals tell us that the savings from introducing specific measurable goals, along with ongoing systems to measure the progress and accountability as to who's directly responsible for achieving those goals, would save taxpayers many billions of dollars. Certainly more than the money we'd find auditing large entities and non-residents engaged in aggressive tax planning. As Auditor General Karen Hogan recently stated, the problems are so fundamental that, in quotes, it seems that agreeing on who will do what and when, who will report to whom, and who will take the lead is persistently difficult. Come on, is that any wonder then that so many tax dollars are consistently wasted? Yet, and don't miss this point, how government spends our tax dollars isn't even on the agenda. It's not mentioned. Massive deficits is our legacy to our children. Not caring how the money's spent is our sin. We got more coming at you in Money Talks. It's not that it was a surprise. I mean, everybody was talking this week, of course, about the half point move from the Bank of Canada with another one promised for June. At least most analysts think that. But the questions start rolling in about mortgages. And I thought, well, let's get Kyle Green on, of course, founder, president of the Green Mortgage Team. Kyle, I know you guys are still exceptionally busy, but let me just start with this. Are you getting some sort of avalanche of a single type of question coming at you?
I take a wild guess. What's happening with interest rates? Should it go variable or fixed? Yeah.
Oh, good. You've read all those questions I'm about to ask.
Exactly.
Well, the thing, though, let me start with this, though, is that, of course, as an example, the bond market had already moved well in advance. I mean, that's the Bank of Canada's job. They want to signal what they're going to do. Surprises are what the market hates. This was not a surprise. Either will a rise in June be a surprise. So the bond market had already moved. And I looked at the five-year bond, of course. They'd had a sharp move up, about 150%, I think, in the last 6 months to a year. So five-year mortgage rates had already moved. So did you get any reaction in the mortgage rate market from the latest move, though, when it became official?
Yeah, a little bit. So a number of lenders did move up their rates just slightly yesterday, but really in the last month, interest rates have skyrocketed. It was about every week lenders said, oh, by the way, we're raising rates again. If you look at the bond chart, bonds are up 1% over the last month. So we've had a lot of movement upwards. It's causing a lot of clients to wonder, should I be going variable? Should I be going fixed? It's interesting because if you look at the bonds now, we're at about a 13-year high for bonds. We haven't seen bonds this high since 13 years ago. And so the question is, are we at a point now where we're going to continue to soar higher, or are we going to start to flatten out at this point?
Just quickly, we saw the prime rate move up immediately. You know, I think it was literally 12 minutes after the Bank of Canada statement that the Royal Bank jumped in and said, we're jumping our prime rate by 0.5%. And every other bank's followed suit, of course. So that impacts variable rate mortgages.
Correct. Yeah. So basically, every quarter point move up costs about $12 per month per 100 grand you're borrowing. And so because the prime rate went up 0.5%, that means that the payments went up about $24 per month per 100 grand that you're borrowing. So a lot of people worry, oh my gosh, a 0.5 point move. You know, if you have a $500,000 mortgage, yes, it's going to impact you a bit, but it's generally not as drastic as most people predict and anticipate. Keep in mind, too, a lot of these people are sitting in variable rates right now that were 1.5 or 1.75%. You can't assume that you're going to be below 2% for the entire course of your mortgage.
Let me, as I say, the consensus is another 0.5 point move coming in June. Has the bond, and I should have said this, the bond market, especially the 5-year Government of Canada bond, is the one that influences what our 5-year mortgage rate is. That's why I asked about the bond market. Have you seen a move already in the bond market? Has it already anticipated that next 0.5 point, certainly a 0.25 point, but the next 0.5 point? Or do you suspect you'll see more activity on that lend translate into the 5-year mortgage market?
My personal opinion is I think that there were a lot of that's already priced in. I think in the last month, we've seen a lot of talk about, especially about the US Fed and what their anticipation is as far as where interest rates are heading for the next little while. So I think that that's already been priced in. In fact, if you look at what a lot of the banks are predicting the 5-year bond yield will be by the end of the year, one bank thinks that they'll be about the same as they are today. Three banks think they'll actually be lower than they are today by the end of the year. And one bank thinks they'll be higher than they are today. And so I think that we might actually be at a 0.5 point for 5-year bond yields, at least for the short term. So be interesting to see what exactly happens. And maybe these need to be tweaked and adjusted. But I don't think that people need to be panicking or freaking out that it's likely that bonds are going to go up another percent, meaning that fixed rates are going to start hitting 5% range. I think that we're going to be around the 4% range for a little while now.
And let me come to the people who took out a 5-year mortgage in 2017. Now, again, I recall that was probably something about 2.7%, you know, people were getting. So now they renew 3.75 or maybe 4, whatever it is. That'll be significant, though, to some degree. I mean, that's a group that I'm sort of thinking about these days.
100%. Yeah, there's going to be a bit of a payment shock here for sure with people that are renewing, especially because as of even a couple months ago, you could get interest rates that are much lower than they are today. You know, we have clients that have rate holds from February that are 2.94%. That same client would be getting 4.14% of the same bank as of now, and we're only a month and a half away from February. So, bit of a shock for sure for individuals that are coming up for renewal. If you are coming up for renewal, some banks will do what's called an early renewal, so they'll actually renew your mortgage 6 to 9 months in advance of the renewal date. In advance of that as well, you can get a rate hold with any lender in the marketplace for 4 months. And so we do this quite often. We have clients that are getting rate holds with us, and then we just evaluate whether the rate holds that we have held are going to be better or worse than what their bank is offering. And then we just make a judgment call on that.
I mean, hugely important to plan ahead. You know, that's music to my ears as someone who worries about people's personal finances, you know, so plan ahead on that. Let's come back to some of the questions you're getting. So somebody's been in a variable rate, they've watched that rate go up. What are the things they should consider in making the decision? Should I lock in now, you know, or not? What are the things I know? Because everybody's individual circumstances will be more. I mean, some people can't afford to have even a bump up more. Others could have lots of room financially. So what are the things they should consider?
Yeah, I mean, we get this question a lot. Should I lock in my mortgage? That's a really, really common question. And I mean, my personal take is no. And the reason for that is most of these clients have variable rates that even with the 0.5 point hike we saw yesterday, you're probably sitting around a rate of 2.5%, give or take. That's still 1.5% off what you'd be locking into today. And I feel like short term anyways, if you're to lock in now, you're taking that 1.5% hike immediately. Whereas if you're in a variable rate, I think that you're going to see that as rates start to slowly go up, and I should say slowly, I mean, really, we're probably seeing a 0.5 point increase in June, but still a lot slower than taking the hike immediately. I still think that it'll take some time before you even reach those levels. And in fact, most banks are still not predicting that we're going to be eclipsing or rising rates enough where you'd see your variable rate actually hit the same level as you'd be locking into in a fixed rate today. Not to mention, the variable rate penalties are way cheaper than fixed rate penalties. It's 3 months interest versus what's called an IRD or interest rate differential penalty. And those can be 5 to 10 times more expensive to break. And a very large percentage of people actually break their mortgages early. It's about 60 67 or 65% of people break their mortgage before their five-year term is up, which means a lot of people end up paying penalties, more people than you suspect.
So again, the difference between the penalty I'll pay if I'm already in a locked-in mortgage, a fixed mortgage, as you say, that's a much more significant than if I'm a variable rate and I want to now go into fixed. So that's one of the considerations you're saying when you deal with individual clients, they're going to add up. Just a quick question on what do you find the financial institution's attitude is about lending? And let me explain why I'm asking that. Like, I'm not sure I want to lend people money at 2% if I have a prognostication that it's going to be a lot higher coming up. So maybe I'm not as keen, or maybe I'll just be more stringent in my qualifications. You know, it's one thing to post a rate. It's quite another for me to get that rate. And I think people have experienced, some people have experienced that. Are you, and I know it's, you can't quantify this. It's just your sense of it at this point.
Yeah. You know, the banks, I will say as far as the rates are concerned, there's one bank in particular that is predicting much higher interest rates than others. That particular bank is also one of the more aggressive lenders moving their rates up currently. And so they've kind of priced themselves out of the market a little bit. So on the rate side of things, yes, I see that one bank pricing themselves out. And they also happen to be the bank that is predicting the highest increases. On the money side of things and the money supply, however, major banks still have a lot of money to lend out. That's not really the problem. But where the problem actually lies is with the credit unions. Credit unions cannot capitalize themselves as easily as major banks can. And so we found that local credit unions, especially for rental properties, are starting to tighten things up. They hit their caps or limit in their what's called a bucket or a pool of funds with rental properties in particular very easily. And so back in 2016, we saw this happen with a few credit unions where they started to tap out on money and started to really restrict lending. Now we're seeing the same thing with rental properties right now. And so some lenders, if you're not a member already, we're not doing rentals for you. If you're buying a property that's too far away from one of our branches, we're not letting you purchase a rental property in that market. So there is a bit of a tightening up, especially the credit unions, but I'm not seeing that with the banks right now.
A couple more questions, if you allow me. One of the things is just, again, your impression. Are you still seeing as many newcomers to the market requesting mortgages? Has that side of the business slowed down?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing. I would say that we definitely had a lot of activity and a lot of new applications come in during the first couple of months of the year. These markets have been really weird. Normally, you have a typical spring market where around March or in April, that's when a lot of applications come in and those people buy and close in June, July, August. The last 2 years, though, that market has shifted backwards. And the craziness has actually been during January, February, March. And I think part of that is because of an extremely low supply of real estate available in the marketplace. And so everyone's jumping over each other to find that one house, you know, 20 people are bidding on the same place. I will say that it seems like the new activity and new applicants coming in is slightly lower. However, a lot of those people that already have a pre-approval are more inclined to buy something now in the next 30, 60, 90 days because the rate will be 1% higher minimum if they don't find something in that next little time frame. So I do see, however, first-time homebuyers in particular are a lot more sensitive to what they hear on the news. I find a real estate investor will hear something on the news and they say, okay, let me think about how that really impacts me. But when a first-time homebuyer watches the news, they think, oh my God, there's no way I'm affording anything. Let's just tap the brakes. Let's not buy anything. And so I'm finding that right now there are less simple, basic first-time homebuyers applying with us to get started.
Let's sum up again for people, though. Again, if you're thinking about getting the market, whether it's an investment property, whether it's a, like a home, your first time, you want to get pre-approved, right? So they could come to a mortgage broker like yourself and say, let's get pre-approved anyways. And now I've got the clock's ticking. I got 90 to 120 days to figure something out. So that's one. Let me come back again. If I'm on a variable rate, it really comes down to individual circumstances. Like if you say, I can't afford this, but your outlook right now is, you know what, you could be paying so much by switching right away, penalty plus increased interest immediately, that maybe it doesn't do you that much good, but it's something to examine. And then the old blend and extend people, you know, you got to be careful of those penalties. If I summed it up kind of correctly there?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And to go into the blend and extend, only a few lenders are offering this as an option now as far as being able to do that. So basically blending and extending means you have 2 years left in your mortgage and you say, okay, I want to extend it up to 5 years. And the lender with no penalty will actually extend you out to 5 years. A lot of lenders have actually stopped doing that now, though. You can still break the mortgage and pay the penalty and get a new five-year term, but it is harder now to do the blend and extend with most banks.
Well, they're listening to the right place. This is on Money Talks. We keep the pulse on, and thanks to you for all your help in doing just that. Kyle Green is president of the Green Mortgage Team. Thanks, Kyle.
Thanks, Mike.
Hey, coming up, I'm going to talk with Mark Leibovit, who has been Timer's Digest of the Year in so many different areas, but also Gold Market Timer of the Year. I'm going to talk to him specifically about the resource market. Is it too late to get in? What about uranium? What about copper? And of course, what about gold? Those kinds of things. But I wanted to get Mike Levy in right now. I saw this story this week, sent it immediately to Mike and said, did you catch this? What it was the U.S. Mint has seen the strongest gold bullion demand in 23 years in the first quarter. Obviously, people are interested. Mike, let me start with you and just ask you a little anecdotal information. You know, down at Border Gold, are you seeing the foot traffic kind of reflect that?
The foot and online traffic too, Mike. It's a very strong year in growth, but it follows years, and this is very important, that are already seeing strong interest, and it highlights the strong North American demand for precious metals. This just brought it right to the forefront, and boy, it was indicative of what was going down or happening at Border Gold. And one of the other things that I've got to point out is just that there's just not a lot of excess metal going around. So we're now experiencing what we experienced last year during COVID when people were flocking to precious metals. Now we're seeing it for different reasons, but it's just a repeat, but almost even more, Mike.
If I bought like a silver coin, or I bought a gold, a Canadian maple leaf, that kind of stuff, would I expect a wait now? Remember when there's all those waits before, when the demand just all of a sudden outstripped supply?
Absolutely, there is the wait. Everybody is getting their metal, but there's no secondary market metal. Now, what do I mean by that? Is Border Gold is full service, as are most of your big gold and silver bullion company. Our companies, they run a market of buy and sell with the spread between. And when we saw the move in gold earlier this year, normally you're going to see sellers in the market, people who bought it back actually before COVID, and they're looking at nice profits now, and they would come in and maybe sell some of their gold or some of their silver. That's not happening this time. People are not only buying, but they're holding on, and that's indicative of the underlying strength in the market. Like,
are you seeing premiums? Like, let's say gold is quoted, I just use an easy number, like $1,950 an ounce. And if I bought an ounce or I bought a maple leaf, am I seeing a little higher premium than normal because of that demand and a shortage, sort of?
Absolutely. That's exactly what we're seeing, because the mint, the Canadian mint, Royal Canadian Mint, and the U.S. Mint are both going full blast, and the premiums are going up. Those dealers that buy, the big, huge dealers that buy, and that includes some of the banks, some of the Canadian banks, well, as they sell into the secondary market or to the smaller dealers, they are demanding a higher spread, but it's universal throughout the business. So dealers are having to pay a higher price, and it's just widening margins. And the thing is that clients are willing to pay that premium. And some of the premiums have us scratching our heads, because they're paying way too much, in my opinion, for an ounce of silver if you're trying to relate to what the spot price of silver is on the market. But if you want physical, and I think that's the direction you and I, Mike, have been talking about this for so long, there's a significant difference between owning the physical and buying the paper. And those that want to own the physical are absolutely going to pay the premium. And, you know, Mike, one other thing, and you talked about this a lot on the air, is Canadians are looking at this a lot differently. Ever since the government came out with the Trudeau's Emergency Act, the Emergencies Act, and freezing bank accounts, and then you add to that the Russian, Ukraine, and geopolitical risk, and then you add to that inflation and loss of purchasing power, and you have huge drivers. But what we've heard at Border Gold is one of the primary drivers was the government action against the citizens of Canada.
Let me ask you one more quick one, Mike. Are you seeing a demand for platinum pickup?
We are seeing some demand. Rob is seeing some demand for platinum, more than we've seen before. And part of it is the feeling that platinum may be a little underpriced to the market, and that will attract more people. But once again, silver is the big mover. Even when we have the premium markup on them, it's still the big mover.
Well, again, this is something I think you're going to be interested in. I'm going to be interested in hearing what Mark Liebowitz got to say. I'm asking him bottom line, what are his charts showing us? Have we already had the move? What's the move? What are his numbers? That kind of stuff. But in the meantime, it's just fascinating to hear that people are sort of voting with their feet on this and taking a position. And of course, Mike, I appreciate you taking time to chronicle it with us.
Thanks, Mike. Have a good Easter weekend.
You too. Time now for the quote of the week. You know, one of the biggest pieces of news this week, or certainly got a lot of coverage, is what I call celebrity business. That's Elon Musk proposing to buy Twitter. I mean, I guess this is the latest development in the high-profile battle between free speech and social media censorship. For many, it's a debate whether who's worse, Twitter or Facebook, in terms of what I'd call unaccountable censorship. I mean, come on, they both, I think, permanently banned the president of the U.S. They banned any mention of the Hunter Biden laptop story, which is now acknowledged to be legitimate. But the thing that really got to me is during COVID, they banned any mention of the Wuhan lab leak theory, which now is sort of the one that most experts would go with. And they got more than a little help from the mainstream media and some universities when it came to censoring any views on government's handling of COVID from a growing number of experts who questioned the government narrative. Arguably the most notable and was the vilification and even official efforts to discredit the experts who signed the Great Barrington Declaration, which, wow, all they stated was, hey, why the lockdown approach is causing too many peripheral problems or knock-on problems like mental illness, child development, delayed medical treatments have a big problem, addiction. And they said instead, efforts should be focused on the elderly and medically vulnerable. By the way, it's interesting how little we hear that approach has now been vindicated by the likes of the Center for Disease Control. That's the context, though, for the quote of the week. But this is an untenured professor at Stanford. And he was writing to Dr. Jay Bhattacharya. He's one of the originators of the Great Barrington Declaration. But he's also a professor of medicine at Stanford, research association at associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. And he says, in quotes, I have heard you several times on television regarding COVID issues and find myself resonating with your views. I'm inclined to express those very same opinions to my colleagues and administrative members at Stanford. I have been reluctant, though, to date because, quite honestly, I expect that my faculty appointment would not be renewed. I have the perception that free speech is just not there. End of quote. Now, that's a concern I've read many times by experts, by epidemiologists who feared for their jobs if they questioned the current orthodoxy. And by the way, we've now come to the next stage of censorship. This is incredible. In California, right now, there's a new bill, Assembly Bill 2098. It's been introduced by a Democrat in the Legislative Assembly that says doctors who deviate from an authorized set of beliefs do so at risk of losing their medical license. Wow. When you consider how many of the tenets of the government narrative about how to treat COVID, how to handle COVID, have now been dismantled. I mean, there's easy ones to recall. Things like, hey, don't wear a mask. That was the first, few months of COVID, then you got to wear a mask. I mean, there is other ones, though, like if you're vaccinated, you can't transmit the virus. Well, obviously, that wasn't true. I mean, there's a long list of them. But to say at the time, at any one of those times, that was against the government official narrative. And to say somebody, a doctor, a professional who deviated from that could lose their license. I mean, that has got to be the epitome of anti-science. There's so many things wrong with trying to censor people in a profession. These are experts who are just questioning the narrative. I mean, it's all about questions. You think about how many things change over the years, including with COVID. when they're talking about don't wear a mask for the first several months to wear a mask to, hey, if you're vaccinated, you can't transmit the COVID virus. I mean, all of that stuff. It's the questions that are important. Last word I'll give to Dr. Vinay Prasad. He's a master of public health, associate professor, Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the University of California in San Francisco. He says, when major decisions must be made amid high scientific uncertainty, as is the case with COVID, we can't afford to silence and demonize professional colleagues with heterodox views. Even worse, we can't allow questions of science, medicine, and public health to become captives of tribalized politics. Today, more than ever, we need vigorous academic debate. Okay, I got good news and bad news for you. The bad news is, as we all know, for the vast majority of Canadians, it's income tax time. We got a couple of weeks left. The clock is ticking. Now, here's the good news. Wait, I have to recover from the bad news, so give me a minute. Okay, now the good news. Tim Sesnick's with me, my favorite CEO of Our Family Office, author of numerous books. And ones, by the way, I must say, that I just found so helpful when it came to my understanding, let alone I could put it in practice, but my understanding of the whole tax code and how it applies to us as individuals. You might read them, Globe and Mail. You've read them in many other places. Tim, appreciate you taking the time. I know this is an extremely busy time for you.
It's my favorite time of year, Michael, not just because of tax time, but the Blue Jays are back playing again. The NHL playoffs are starting. So what's not to like about April?
Well, let's throw in the Raptors, too. I'm a big Raptors fan. I think they start tonight. Saturday game. So yes, I'll be all over all of those things. Yeah, I won't have to actually during the COVID, this is the time I didn't mind not leaving the couch. Tim, let's talk about, and just straightforward, I want to give people some straightforward advice or things to put on their radar. Bottom line, two big questions. What's changed for 2022? I'll start with that.
Yeah, good question. You know, there's always some things that do change every year. I think when it comes to the best kind of tax planning, really not much has changed over the last year. Obviously, people are going to have to report certain kinds of income that maybe they didn't have to report in prior years. You know, if you received any government benefits and that kind of thing because of COVID, the pandemic benefits, those are all taxable for the most part. So some people may have some things like that they need to report. Other than that, there was no new tax credits that were introduced with the exception of one. That is called the Canada Training Credit, which some people can claim. It's if you are employed and you want to go back and take a course to upgrade your skills, anything like that, the government is providing a tax credit. You can claim up to $250, not $1,000, $250 each year. And if you don't use that $250 in a particular year, it gets carried forward. So over the course of your lifetime, you can claim up to $5,000 of actual course costs in a lifetime. And you can claim a credit for the cost of taking those courses. So that's new as well for this year.
I didn't want to confuse anyone. We're talking, of course, in April 2022, but it's for the 2021 tax year. And make sure everyone, I didn't confuse anyone with that. Let me come to another aspect of this is that, you know, I can't even imagine how many tax forms you've looked at over the course of your career. But do you find there's sort of a consistency on things that people overlook or completely skip maybe or other times overlook?
Yeah, absolutely. There's some simple things that people often overlook. We'll talk about a few of them. And, you know, when it comes to sort of pensions or RSPs, there's a couple of things that come to mind. One is the RSP deduction. So if you contributed to your RSP for the year 2021, so you would have made that contribution last year or even up till the end of February of this year, you can claim that deduction on your tax return for 2021, but you don't have to. And so if you expect your income to be higher in 2022 or even next year in 2023, you might actually want to save that deduction because you don't have to claim it and you can claim it in the future. So you'll save more tax by claiming it in a year when your income is actually higher. And people forget that.
And in the meantime, they've been earning some income tax-free. I mean, that's the advantage of doing it early with the accountant, as you say. But that's an important point that people can have some selection within that, doing that way. What's the deal with the tax-free savings account? Is that a carry forward or how do they work?
Yeah, so the tax-free savings account, unlike your RSP, does not give rise to a tax deduction, all right? But but it is still good to contribute to the plan. When you take the money out, it comes out tax-free, as many people will know. So you get this tax-sheltered growth inside the plan, and then you pull it out at the end of the, whenever you want to pull it out for using it for, you know, whatever purpose, but you're not going to have to pay tax when you pull it out. Now, when you contribute, the amount you can contribute to this plan increases every year. So if you, if you've been maximizing your contributions, you can add another $6,000 for 2022. If you haven't contributed to one of these plans since, you know, for the last 12 years since they've been available, then you're probably eligible to put quite a bit of money into the plan right now, up to over $80,000, in fact. So make sure you do use this plan. And maybe something we can chat about before the end of this call is also something that came about in the federal budget last week, which is sort of a hybrid between an RSP and a TFSA that was introduced by the government. And it won't be available till next year, but it's an interesting plan that will help people save for a home, or even if you're not going to use the savings for a home, will bump up your retirement savings.
It's interesting. I was talking a little bit about that in my comment to open the show from a couple of standpoints, though. One, as I was laughing to myself, I thought someone like Tim is going to love this because it'll save people money on tax. And someone like me can't help themselves going, but look at all the other costs you're adding to home ownership. And that drives me crazy. But that is an important aspect also that we will be talking about in the next year. But I'm glad you point that out, though. It doesn't kick in until next year.
Exactly. But I think when it comes to pensions too, Michael, also people should be remembering that if you're receiving a pension from work, I'm not talking about the Canada Pension Plan, I'm talking about a pension through your work, you can split that pension income with your spouse. So up to half of your income can be reported on your spouse's return so that you only pay tax on the other half. And that's a perfect way to split income. It's perfectly legal, it's endorsed. And a lot of people forget to do that, in fact. So don't forget, you can split that pension income as well.
So obviously from the higher income earner, whether it's the man or the woman, into the lower, or your spouse in any other relationship, into that. Does it have to be a married relationship, by the way?
No, it doesn't. It actually needs to be the person that you're splitting with has to be your spouse, but spouse is defined to be legally married or living common law. Oh. So if you've been living for 12 months together for 12 months or more, then you also count.
That could be an attractive way. Maybe I should. No, I'm just kidding. But but that is an important caveat. Yeah, I mean, they're not just opening it up, but you've got to have lived with someone for 12 months. And that's the real caveat in your family. Let's talk about kids for a second here. Now, sure. There's so many. I mean, we went through this period where governments wanted to do a marketing plan, kind of. They wanted to market. So instead of just giving us an overall tax break, they started to say things like, well, if your kid takes an art class, or if your kid, you know, get some exercise. And I always felt that didn't make a ton of sense from the tax point of view, but it did from the political marketing point of view. See, we care about your kids, or kids in education, or kids in exercise.
Yes, exactly. Now they've taken away some of those credits, which some parents were actually liked, where you get credits for putting your kids into art classes or piano lessons or sports teams and things like that. Those credits are gone now. What they've done instead a couple of years back is the government decided to increase the universal child care benefit. It's a payment that parents get every month for looking at, you know, for to help look after the cost of your kids. And they give that out instead now, which is in replacement of a couple of these tax credits. So I'm not sure kids are, whether it's a change the number of kids that are taking piano lessons or out there playing soccer or hockey, I don't know, but people liked those credits when they were around.
Yeah, again, because they were so targeted that people could recognize that they got that, as opposed to a broad-based one. It's interesting within that context. But within that, I want to come back to something you said earlier, because obviously all of the support that we got during the pandemic was new to people. It was new to the government, but new to people. And I know, for example, now, again, some people were very critical of this, but high school students were collecting CERB, you know. Yes. So again, do they, if someone did collect CERB, can we go through who has to report that?
Yeah, so basically what's happening is anybody who legally collected CERB and received it does have to report it in the year they received it. So that a lot of that was reported in the year 2020, but some of it would have been collected in 2021 as well, some of those benefits. So, and also CRA has an audit project on the go right now. They're checking up on people to see, should you have actually received this? And if you shouldn't have received it, you may actually have to pay it back. Now, we met one family where, you know, the kids actually reported their CERB benefits on their tax returns for 2020 and then had to pay it back a few months later. So they will get a tax deduction in 2021 when they paid it back. But CRA is looking to collect money back from people who shouldn't have received it. So people should be aware of that.
And the other side is if someone sits there and says, you know what, I didn't earn enough money. How much can I earn without owing federal and provincial tax, for example?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, the number, fortunately, is actually going up a little bit. By next year, 2023, it will be $15,000 that you can earn before you start paying any tax at all. This year, it's a little bit under that. The actual amount depends actually on how much income you have. The more income you have, if you're in the highest tax bracket, your basic personal exemption will be a little bit less. It'll be about $12,000. And if you are earning less money, you'll get closer to $13,000 tax-free. But and when you're a student, for example, you add to that your tuition that you're able to claim. Most students could earn somewhere between $15,000 and $20,000 before they pay any tax at all. And the average person who's not in school can earn probably close to $15,000.
So let's say I earn $12,000, and let's just make sure I'm exempt at that point. There's nothing special going on. Okay. Is it an advantage for me to still file, even though I don't owe anything?
Absolutely. If you earned income of any kind, you should file, because what that does is it creates contribution room for RSP purposes. So even if you don't owe any tax, you still want to file. And besides that, once you're age 19 or older, you may be entitled to a GST or HST credit, which comes back as a payment to you every quarter, about $400 a year for some people. So just by filing a return, you let the government know you're there, that you're eligible for these credits or this contribution room, and that's worthwhile doing.
A couple of more areas. I know I've taken a bit too much of your time because I know you are busy, but I wanted to just get to two more quick areas. Let's talk to investors for a second. And again, safety deposit box, can I deduct that? My fees or where? What can I deduct off of my capital gains or my, if it's interest income, for example?
Yeah, so there are a number of what are called carrying charges that investors can deduct. Safety deposit box fees, actually, surprisingly, is not one of those things. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things people always have claimed. And to be honest with you, CRA doesn't typically reassess people or notice, but I'm not telling you that it's okay to do it, just saying that's not supposed to be deducted. But things like investment management fees or fees on funds that you invest in, accounting fees, tax preparation fees, these things are all deductible as long as you're earning investment income. So if that income is inside of a registered plan, then generally you can't deduct the fees because you're not taxed on your investment income every year. But if you're reporting interest income, you're reporting dividends every year, or even capital gains, then you can start deducting things like these accounting fees, tax preparation fees, investment management fees, for sure. And actually interest costs. So something people overlook often, Michael, is check your brokerage statements. You may have paid some interest on maybe a debit balance in your account, or if you're borrowing on margin. And that interest cost that shows up on your brokerage statements would be deductible.
Okay, just quickly, let's talk about real estate and just everything to do with real estate. For example, so anything that was a cost associated with, I have a rental property. You know, does that include like I had to travel to see potential renters? Obviously, if I put an ad in a newspaper, social media, what other things are sort of all involved in that?
So a rental property is very similar to running a business. What that really means is any costs are deductible, provided they were incurred for the purpose of earning this income, this rental income. So yeah, that could be travel costs to go see the property. You know, we have a small rental property about 2.5 hours north of the city. When I go there, I often have lunch up there because, you know, it takes the better part of a day to go up and back. I'll deduct part of that cost. So it really is like a business, which is good news, which means most things that relate to the property will be deductible. And so you don't want to forget everything from utilities to your typical things, property taxes, mortgage interest, all those kind of things.
Keep records. That's the other thing that comes back to me when you have all of these. Protect yourself that way. Okay, let's get the final category into self-employed or people who are sort of perceived, like I know a lot of realtors who are considered for tax reasons, self-employed.
Yes. Yes. So for sure, self-employment is still probably the greatest tax shelter. I know I've been saying that for a few years, but it really is. And that's because you can earn some kind of income doing whatever it is, whether it's selling real estate, whether it's, knitting, selling some other product or service. And by earning any income at all, it opens the door to deducting things you're paying for anyway. Things like utilities at home, part of your mortgage interest, property taxes, a part of your vehicle costs. You're paying for these things anyway. Why not make them part of your business where you can write these things off? The only thing I'll caution people about is this. It's quite often the case where your deductions will be higher than your income, your revenues in the early years of having a home-based business. So that's okay for a couple of years. But once you've been claiming losses for 3 years, 4 years in a row, that puts a little flag on your tax return, and CRA may come back and really determine, are you really running a hobby here, or do you have a reasonable expectation of actually making a profit? And if they don't think you have an expectation of a profit in a given year, they could deny your expenses and deny your enough expenses where your loss will be denied effectively. So just be aware of that. You have to at some point start showing a profit.
Okay, last thing. If I wanted to avoid getting an audit, what are the sort of tips you would give me? Obviously, sometimes I hear that they do just sort of a blanket audit, everybody who has X, I can't avoid that. But other than that, can you give me a couple of tips to avoid getting audited?
Yeah, so there is a difference between a review and an audit. A review is where, you send in your tax return electronically. They just want to make sure you actually had that donation receipt. So they want you to send them a copy of it. That's a review. An audit is where generally is reserved for people who run businesses, where they want to check and see, okay, are these expenses actually valid? Are they overstated? The things to do to avoid that kind of situation is, first of all, just have a backup for all your expenses. As long as you've got backup to support what you're deducting or claiming, you'll have no problem. There are areas that they typically target. So if you're in certain industries like waitressing or waitering or construction, you're probably eventually going to get audited, unfortunately, because those are areas where a lot of cash changes hands. So those are industries in general that are kind of on the radar. If you're not in one of those industries, though, you probably have very little to worry about as long as you've got receipts for things. I wouldn't worry about it. There are certain years they may look at childcare expenses 1 year. Well, not much you can do about that. You're just going to have to send in your receipts if they ask for them, right? But just keep your receipts and you'll be fine.
Tim, I want to thank you for taking the time. You're always there for us, giving terrific advice, well explained. And I know it's a busy time, as I said at the outset, so we much appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Michael.
Tim Cesnik is CEO of Our Family Office. Time now for the shocking stat of the week. Today, I'm going to talk about some of the most important areas, or one of the most important areas of personal finance. But look at what we're being greeted with. We've got higher interest rates and inflation. Well, that's not shocking. We all know that. But I want to take this opportunity to make sure that one aspect of our personal finance that is so regularly overlooked is brought to your attention. Yeah, we're taking it on all slides. I mean, you'd be forgiven for thinking that the price of everything is going up. Well, it is. When we're talking about the big three, food, shelter, and energy. I mean, we can put off buying other things like food or rather furniture or clothing, but not those big three. But when we report them, we hear about the price rises. Good example this week, Amazon's adding 5% an inflation and fuel charge to all sellers starting April 28th, but it's going to get passed on to us. But is it really 5%? That's the part I want to bring to your attention. Every one of the increases that we're experiencing, milk was up 8.4% as an example. Of course, gasoline. But one of the most important concepts is to understand that you're paying all of that with after-tax dollars. Consumers pay the increase with money they first earn, then pay income tax. So it's not just an 8.4% increase. No, you've got to earn something in the neighborhood for the average Canadian of like 11 or 12%, then you pay the tax to leave 8.4% increase left over. I mean, I know there's a variety of individual circumstances, but I want to make sure we've got the idea because it makes the price increases far more onerous for millions of Canadians who don't have a lot of money at the end of the month. I mean, broadly speaking, Canadian full-time workers pay about 30 cents in provincial and federal income tax on the next dollar they earn. So if they get a raise, they only keep about 70 cents of it. And that's only the income tax part. Of course, you're going to pay a myriad of other taxes too. I mean, whether it's GST and PST in every province but Alberta, but you know about liquor sales taxes, and you know that gas taxes, property taxes, carbon tax, all of that kind of stuff. But the point I want to make today is that it's not just that rise. It's if you're going to get the money together to pay for the rise, you've got to earn whether it's 30% more to a max of 54% more. And this is important. I mean, keep in mind, at the beginning of the year, you had the Dalhousie Agri-Food Analytics Lab saying that the average family of four would pay $966 more for food. And I bet that's higher now because we've seen record wheat and corn prices, et cetera. But you'll have to earn $1,300, most people, or more, up to $2,000 or more. You got to earn that much extra to pay for that extra food. That's the part I want to bring to your attention. When you hear about these increases, always put them in the context as I'm paying for it with after-tax dollars. Ergo, I've got to earn even more than the increase is stated. Once again, I'm very pleased to have Mark Leibovit with me. And as any regular listener to Money Talks knows, that Mark has been showered with accolades over his long-term career, whether it's been Timers Digest, Market Timer of the Year, Long-Term Timer of the Year, Gold Market Timer of the Year. You're getting the idea here. He's got a fabulous track record. He looks at all sorts of things in the market, by the way, whether it's just timing. He was one of the literally the pioneers in marijuana and that sector, whether it's the sector or the industries that service the marijuana side or whether it's the companies themselves. But he puts out the Canna Sector Report, Trading Ace. He's got the Silver Forecaster, the Platinum. You're getting the idea here, as I say. Mark Leibovit joins me. Mark, thanks for finding time.
Oh, my goodness. It's a pleasure. Thanks, Mike.
I want to delve into one aspect that you do a lot, Oz, because it's so topical right now. I want to sort of stay focused on it to some degree. And that's, of course, you write the metals and resource letter, and that's the area I want to look at. Okay. One of the questions I'm getting, Mark, all the time is, okay, so Money Talks has been big on saying be in that kind of commodity sector. But now the question I'm getting is it too late if I don't have a position? What broadly are you seeing there from your charts?
No, we're still in an uptrend. And I still think, timing is good here. My models pretty much suggest that through the course of this year, at least into the third quarter, I think you're going to see strength. So it's not too late at all. In fact, as you know, gold itself or silver have not broken out into new highs. We double topped in gold, a couple months ago and pulled back. Silver, sort of struggled to get up into the high 20s, never really broke out. So there's a good chance we could see that by now and I would say the fall. So let's see how it plays out. But like big stocks, for example, Newmont Mining into all-time highs, for example, this past week or so. I mean, that's a pretty damn good sign, I think. So we got momentum is there.
It's interesting within that sector. I think people would have been surprised that they wouldn't get more strength. As you say, though, gold is now bumping up a little bit. Maybe it's more into the silver side. We're still, quite a few percentage points away from their recent highs, not the all-time high of whatever it was, $55 with the Hunt brothers. But they were sort of thinking with this inflationary environment, we may have seen more money flow into that. But are you seeing volumes, at least in the trading side of things, whether it's the exchange-traded funds or some of the stocks themselves, are you seeing volumes picking up?
Absolutely. My biggest concern, we hardly talk about this at all, the manipulation in the gold market, the suppression of the gold market and silver market, more gold and silver, which is going on for decades. There's an organization, GATA.org. I don't know if you ever researched and did their work. I get their stuff every day. I mean, we have government suppression going on in the gold market for decades. I mean, gold should be $5,000 an ounce or even higher. So this is a whole other issue and whether politically that's going to change or not. But we got to take out that double top high in the gold, which was that 2060, 2070 area. Then I think we could have some momentum. I would be very disappointed if we didn't see that, as I mentioned a moment ago, by the third quarter, that we really break out and really take off here. But to answer your question, yes, there's upside volume, higher projections, the price action in a name like a Newmont and some of the other leaders in the group. I'm leveraged. I own, for example, Nugget and UGT, which is double long bull. Gold stocks and also JNUG, which is double the junior gold miners. So, I'm in there with those and we're up in them. And honestly, I see no reason on the charts. We're just sort of creeping up there back to that recent high. I'm just waiting, holding my breath moment to moment for that breakout to occur. So I know it's not the bottom, Mike, but I still think the wind's at our back, you know?
I'll get you to reiterate a couple things there. One is the sort of the target numbers you're looking at are $2,060, $2,070. That's the sort of the ceiling mark you're watching to see if we're going to break out to a new level.
Right. It's also interesting, you know, we see the strength in the U.S. dollar through this whole period of time. And normally that would be a big burden on the gold market, but yet it still hasn't been able to make progress. So I always talk about how you can't tie markets together. You know, you got to look at them individually. For years, I've been saying this because you get the view, oh, it can never go up because the dollar is strong. Dollar could go up and gold could go up. We've seen this happen many times. So it's interesting. You got to watch that tape action, the technical action. But I've been very encouraged the fact that both have been moving, you know, so that's a key point.
And could you give us, you know, more slowly the symbols for the two ETFs, the double ETFs that you just mentioned?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm talking a little quickly. NUGT for Nugget, which is the 2X, two double gold shares, the main, the big names, you know? And then if you want to have a 2X double position in the junior miners, which I think is a good play to be because it's a catch up, is JNUG, J-N-U-G. This is both on NASDAQ.
Okay, sorry, thanks. I just want to make sure because you got people busily listening and trying to jot those symbols down at the same time so they can have a look with their financial advisor and see where that fits and whether it does or not in their portfolio. But your point more is you're watching supported volumes because we talked to Michael Levy earlier on the show about more on the feet on the ground kind of thing with Border Gold and, you know, people lining up to get in there. And it just seems like, you know, and I had listed some things like, you know, some central banks making significant increases in their holdings of gold over the last couple of months. So that's why I was asking, because it sort of feels like there is that momentum building.
Right. And you've also got, you know, the Russian-Ukrainian situation going on. And in particular, the fact that Russia has been a big hoarder of gold and they're now backing the ruble with gold, too. And, you know, this is a very big statement because China and Russia are now you know, in the League of Thieves together, so to speak. And, you know, they're very big proponents of a gold standard, particularly backing their currencies. So they're huge in there. And I think that, you know, the world's changing, Mike. I mean, China is taking over. We know that economically, politically, the way they've acted both in the Mideast and around the world, and the fact that their currencies and are backed or are being backed by gold and they're accumulating it. This is a big, very big statement about where gold's going. You got to. It's just not what's happening here. You know what I mean? So I think it's important.
So again, people just take note of that. You know, obviously everybody's got an individual portfolio and what works for them on sort on a lot of different levels. But again, one of our recommendations, Mark, is what we have found that you should have a position. And the reason is once things start to move, they move so darn quickly, it's tough to get on board. I mean, I'm talking across the spectrum. You know, obviously, you've got an unusual situation like nickel. But, you know, really, once the commodities started to move, presto, all of a sudden, it was very tough to catch that train. And oil is the one that jumps out at me on that, you know, another one of our big commodity winners. What are you seeing on the oil chart?
Well, the charts, as I mentioned in previous interviews, have shown some really crazy numbers in the crude oil market. I mean, numbers like $300-$400 a barrel over the next several years is possible. And it might be theoretically a short squeeze, a super short squeeze, much to the inverse of like we saw in March 2020 when crude oil did the impossible, supposedly, when it went negative $30 or $40 a barrel temporarily in the futures market. So I think the, you know, the political nonsense going on out there, particularly here in the U.S. about curtailing oil production, the demand worldwide, the need for it in the EV movement, could really create a very interesting squeeze here. And I'm not saying it's going straight up, but my model, at least for this year, you're going to still see crude oil higher, and it might surprise everybody how high it could go. So that, of course, you have the inflationary forces pushing it as well.
Well, I mean, and that's what, you know, again, I'm getting those kind of questions asked is, you know, because we've had a nice move. Money Talks has been behind the move in that and other commodities. And so they're going, what now? So that's an important sort of backdrop, the map that you're getting there.
Mike, we could see a short squeeze at the very end of this move. Let's say I'm right and we're strong into the third quarter of this year. I mean, we're going to back up to gold here. I mean, gold, if it breaks out, you could get a panic move, which could be a blow off top. I mean, you know, because we're watching this stuff technically. Suddenly we surge to 2,300, 2,500, you know, 3,000, some crazy number. That would be a great exit point, you know, from my perspective, if we see that within the cycle time frame. So same thing with crude oil. Maybe we'll get a blow off here into roughly the third quarter of the year, and that'll be your trading exit point. And not necessarily a long-term end of the move, but definitely a stopping point, you know? So something to keep in mind if it happens.
We're talking about renewables for a moment. Let me come back to some of the metals that are involved there. And again, that's one of my thesis has been, they're going ahead with renewables no matter what the constraints are. There's a phenomenal shortage, which has not been part of the conversation. It's so unrealistic to suggest we can have this huge rollout of renewables without getting a phenomenal increase in metals like nickel or metals like copper. We obviously need lithium. I mean, that list is quite a long one. So I was wondering again, what are you showing on the charts of something like copper or something like nickel? Although nickel may be just way off, you know, in La La Land, given the kind of squeeze that we've seen there, the very short squeeze you were just referring to in other potential metals and oil.
Yeah, that nickel was definitely an example of a short squeeze, right? I mean, we can see these dramatic moves very quickly. Copper is still in an uptrend, zigzagging higher, still looks good on the charts. Aluminum still looks strong. You know, the platinum palladium group, nickel, as you suggested, zinc, all the, you know, just the worldwide demand for this stuff and shortages. And we're still in a cyclic positive time frame. Obviously, it's not going to go up forever and there's going to be a blow off. But, you know, I would stay with it definitely for now. And, you know, I'm a little concerned about the equity markets, particularly with interest rates going up. And that there's a lot of outlier events out there. You know, COVID is increasing now, supposedly in China, and we don't know the result of the Russian-Ukraine situation, whether it's going to expand or not. And we got a Federal Reserve, which has gone crazy. We got, former Fed Governor Dudley talking about we need to raise rates even if it crashes the stock market. I mean, these crazy things that are happening. So this is good for the metals. It's bad, possibly, I think, for the stock market, because I'm short the stock market. But definitely there's going to be some volatility here and a lot of money to be made if you're positioned.
And again, it's a good warning for people too, that, you know, I'm always saying this, Mark, so I'm hardly an insightful comment, but people have to review their portfolio, decide what risk they want to take some money off the table in some areas, which I bet anyone who was in those kinds of, I call sort of mid-tier aggressive tech stocks probably wish they had taken some money off the table. But again, it's an argument for reviewing. And I think you did a great list there. I mean, look at what the Federal Reserve is saying, but we don't know how China is going to play out with COVID. I mean, they have over 80 cities in lockdown right now. And I keep reading reports, they may ease things. And then I read another report, I think it was on Friday, basically saying, no, Xi Jinping says we're committed to zero policy. Well, what will that do to demand for things, you know, and supply chains? I mean, this environment is one with uncertainty and with risk, and one has to govern themselves accordingly, I think, with their portfolio.
Right. So the bottom line for me is I maintain the position in the, you know, the futures, the commodity plays, including agricultural, which we haven't talked about. I mean, they're really taking off, and there's shortages, fertilizer issues, a whole bunch of company stocks making new highs the last few days in that agricultural fertilizer sector, but I would be in those and pretty much out of the S&P and the Dow and the you know, not so much the TSX because that's more commodity related, but it's going to be wild here. So that's sort of my position. I'm short stocks, long this whole futures commodity sector, and I think it could hold here for a few months.
Let me come back to the agricultural, as that's been one of my big concerns, not just my interest in terms of an investment portfolio, but of course, we've been talking pretty relentlessly. I think I've got some listeners who'd say, well, you stop talking about it, but starvation kind of gets my attention. And we're talking about a level of starvation in some parts of the world, and certainly escalating food prices, and you can't afford it. Whether you're a low-income person, it's not like you can say, well, I'm not going to eat. Yes, you can maybe change what you're eating, but you are definitely going to be impacted by the food price increase. So let me break that down. Let me come first to the fertilizer side. You still see opportunities there.
Yes, stocks like NTR, Nutrien, Intrepid Potash, IPI, Mosaic, MOS, CF, which CF Industries, these are all fertilizer type plays. In fact, NTR is based in Saskatchewan, as you probably know, the Canadian fertilizer company, all into into new high ground. And this is, you know, of course, it's a panic situation, but we don't know when it's going to be over. You know, talking about a stock like Costco, I know I'm deviating here a little bit into all-time highs, despite what's going on in the stock market. When I go into the store, I don't know if you've noticed, but it seems like there's less food on the shelves. And I think there could be some hoarding going on as well, which could be driving a stock like Costco and others higher. So this is all part of this puzzle. It's just amazing what's going on. Fertilizer, shortages of food. But, you know, we're on the capitalist side here. We're trying to tell our clients, how do we protect ourselves financially? So it's terrible what's happening with the food shortage situation. No doubt about it.
That's exactly what we're trying to do on Money Talks. Exactly. I can't change any of these things. I think we've done a brilliant job forecasting them and saying position for it. But our big thing is, this is a historic time. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, Mark, but I think we're talking monetary crisis, obviously commodity crisis, energy crisis. And my big goal is to protect people, you know, and that's the question I get. How do I protect myself? I don't want to just be a victim to these things. And that's so we share that same goal. And in that regard, when you look at the actual agriculturals like the wheat, the corn, and some others, are there sort of area or stocks that you like within those broad areas, or is that a commodity play?
Yeah, well, one good name would be Andersons, ANDE, which is the agribusiness, ANDE. Archer Daniels Midland, ADM is another name, which is the food and commodity trading. Those would be two good names. We're also seeing new highs in stocks like Deere and Caterpillar. Deere more than Caterpillar, because they're, you know, they're out there in the farming sector as well. But the other way to play it are the ETFs, like WEAT for wheat, SOYB for soybeans, CORN for corn, DBA, which is the ETF for commodities and agriculture. So there are stock plays there, no doubt about it. I have them on my list.
And I'm still a long-term bull on those things. Like, I just don't see any sign of those problems being rectified. You know, I mean, as long as you have these record high natural gas prices, you got a fertilizer problem. And of course, potash is there. Diesel, of course, is adding to the cost for farmers. So all of that stuff comes into this thing. And I'm proud of the fact on Money Talks, we were talking about that well before anybody else was. You know, I think some politicians have just discovered there might be a food crisis. Well, we knew about that 2 years ago. we were baking the cake for that. Mark, let me just finish with this. When you're looking out there and you've got both, of course, you are Timers Digest. You've been Timer of the Year in so many different areas. And obviously your unique proprietary approach to the market has served you and your subscribers very well. So, and by the way, I've got something to talk about in subscriptions in just a second, but let's come just again to the big themes that I want to leave people with today, as I say, because our goal is to protect them. So you're being cautious about the stock market, still bullish. There's still room on a lot of the commodities we talked about, and especially the agriculturals too, but oil could be special in there. So it kind of warrants, depending on one's individual circumstances, at least a position in those areas.
Absolutely. And, you know, owning a couple inverse ETFs for the stock market, I don't think is such a bad idea. I mean, you know, we own long ETFs when the market's going up. You know, why not own a couple inverse ones like SH, which is the inverse ETF for the S&P, for example? You know, it's only a $14 stock, but at least you got your foot in the door. And if there's a 10-20% shakeout in the stock market, which I could see easily happening here the next few months, at least you're making a little bit of money, and doesn't have to be a big part of your portfolio. But why not own a little SH, which is a cheap way of inverse playing the S&P, you know?
Mark, let me just ask one more question before I let you go, and that's about uranium. As you know, we've been bullish, and I know you directed us in that way. So tell me a little bit about what you're seeing in the uranium market.
Yeah, still very strong. CCJ, which is, I guess, the blue chip name, into new highs. I don't need common sense. I mean, where is the energy going to come from to support the EV movement that everybody's so excited about? It's not going to come from wind power. It's not going to come from geothermal. It's not going to come from solar, the building of nuclear plants, which is big around the world, not so much here in the U.S., but the I guess, the shift in thinking that uranium is going to be the answer and is in progress, I think, is a play. So you got to have a core position in the name, a blue chip name, like I would say a CCJ, and NLR is a ETF for the whole uranium industry, I suppose, is another way to play it. But definitely uranium has got to be part of this diversified metals energy complex that we've been talking about.
That's great. Hey, by the way, I always leave this till the end of the show because I don't want you to be mad at me. But we talked to your people before as we were telling them this is what we want to talk about. And we asked if they would give us, our Money Talks listeners, a bit of a break on your metals and resource letter and your annual forecast issue. And I'm sorry to tell you, but happy to tell our listeners, they said yes. So again, people can go to mikesmoneytalks.ca, mikesmoneytalks.ca, and they get 50% off. Wow, 50% off the metals resource letter and the annual forecast issue. But the reason is this, you've got to stay up to date in these markets. We've seen tremendous movement there. And this is one of the great ways of just keeping track of what the prices are doing, what the technicals are telling us is coming forward. We know the fundamental story, but again, we're talking about pricing, about volume, that kind of stuff. So the metals resource letter plus the annual forecast issue. So Mark, let me just finish with saying, I always appreciate you finding time for us. Fascinating talk.
My pleasure, Mike. Have a happy Easter and thank you for having me.
Well, lots of questions about real estate. Talked with Kyle Green about the mortgage market here, but it's more than that. I want to get Ozzie Jurek in here because the big question for me is, I watched some of the moves by the government of Canada. I watched some of the moves in the mortgage market, which, as we had said, had already kind of started. Boy, this is the big question on people's minds seem to be, when it will actually have a material impact in slowing the market. What kind of things are you looking at, Ozzie Jurek?
Well, one thing is for sure, interest rates are the major component. You've talked about that for years, that interest rates determine to a very large extent how our economy is going. And now, with the increases at 0.5%, as I wrote extensively in my Oswald's blog, it's going to make a huge difference. It did now, and now we're going to have maybe another 0.5% in June. The idea that people don't understand, we seem to be attacking again the first-time buyer. The very person, we argue government argues affordability, and we want to help the little guy. Well, the little guy has a stress test where he has to qualify at 5.25% or 2% above the bank rate. Well, the bank rate has already risen to the around 4% level, so he has to qualify at 6%, shortly maybe at 6.5%. Well, every 0.5% increase means about $25 or so, so on $100,000. So $500,000 mortgage, which is about the average in Vancouver, and there's a heck of a lot of mortgages more than that. Well, five times 20, all of a sudden it's $125 more. And there comes a point where that, just that very fact, will slow down the first time buyer and saying, well, I'm going to give up.
And as I was saying earlier in the shocking stat, just again, trying to make people sensitive with this, all of these price movements are after tax dollars. So you actually had to earn more. You need a raise that would cover that plus 30, plus 50%, depending on the tax bracket. So yeah, these things are really adding up because it's not in isolation, as we all know, Ozzie, as you know, I've been mentioning. Of course, you've got all these other inflationary pressures, let alone just interest rates on this. But the other one I want to talk about, well, actually, let me just get one more thing here, because the thing you mentioned about first-time buyers, because I'm not sure at what point it starts making it less, you can't qualify is what I'm trying to find to say. You know, that all of a sudden, because you got a stress test, you can't qualify.
Yeah, and I think, let's say, if 5.25% still had a strong market, I tell you, time you get to 7, it will knock the first-time buyer right out of the market because the high rates of mortgage that they had to borrow to begin with. And I also see the market slowing a little bit. But you know, Mike, in addition to that, and you and I talked about it before, the government is standing right beside the troublemaking interest rates, because now, of course, even if you want to assign your contract as a pre-sale buyer, you have to pay GST. I mean, where does that come from? It hasn't completed, it has not been transferring title, but you still have to pay GST. Now, what people don't understand is that without the pre-sale buyer, there won't be any building because the banks want 60% of the units sold before they give you construction financing. So now the flipper is going to say, well, I'm going to get out of this because, I mean, I'm going to be taxed. What if I move the title from my company into my own name? Does that attract GST? And, Mike, in addition to that, anybody that wants to buy a property today and renovate it, like, You know, a normal handyman takes a property, renovates it, and then sells it. But now if he sells it within a year, as of May 7, that attracts again a full taxation of income rather than the capital gain that he had before.
I want to come back to the pre-sales just for a sec, because it's an area that some people aren't as aware of, and that is, you know, developers use the pre-sale market. The bank wants to see it to know the viability of the project. Well, if you've just discouraged pre-sales by saying, hey, you do a pre-sale, you're still paying GST up front. Well, that has a lot of ramifications right through the development market.
Yeah, it looks like you have to pay. Now, we don't have all the details, but it looks like I assign my contract to you, that action attracts the GST. And of course, once you buy it, that attracts the GST again. You know, it's like they're sitting there and saying, I wonder how we can make it more difficult to slow down the market when at the same time we have hundreds of thousands of people not having any accommodation.
Well, as I say, more uncertainty, that doesn't help. But I've got to throw one other thing at you, Ozzie. And that is, I'm looking around at stuff like the cost of rebar. And of course, that's been going through the roof. We all know, I think, about lumber prices going through the roof. I mean, this is getting incredibly expensive when you start talking about developing, and now you've raised interest rates.
No question. In fact, I talked to a developer, a high-rise construction. He says his costs are going up at about 1% a month. Well, think about it. On a three-year construction, that's a 36% increase. And, you know, I talked to another developer. He says, hey, 1% is much too low, depending on what it is that's going up. It could go going up as much as 2 to 3%. And the question here is, your developer, if you have a pre-sale, you know, did he fix his costs 2 years ago? Did he pre-buy the lumber? Did he pre-buy the equipment? If he did, nothing to worry about. But if he didn't, will he still make a profit? So you have to be very cautious in all of these things to find out, you know, where you stand as a buyer in the future. You might have to just ask the question of the developer and saying, what's your financial strength?
Well, let me ask you about protection. If I do a pre-sale, and let's say, as you say, I didn't fix my costs as a developer, and we've all seen these massive increases in costs, and they say, well, you know, we can't complete. We're not going to go forward. What protection do I have as someone who's bought the pre-sale?
Well, it's kind of interesting you should say that, because we do have actually in Richmond a company called Elder Bridgeway that they were originally going to build 800 units, and I believe some 288 units were sold in 2019. They just went for protection against creditors. So what they wrote, and that's interesting for all pre-sale buyers, they wrote to their buyers, we, the owner of this atmosphere project, want to assure our pre-sale buyers that the deposits are held in trust and protected. And that's the law in British Columbia, that all deposits or pre-sales are put in trust.
Well, that's certainly to ask about too, no matter what province you're listening to us from, make sure you've got that protection. I guess another question very quickly, Ozzie, becomes what the financial wherewithal of the company, the developer you're dealing with. I'm not sure how to get that information, but it seems a question to me.
Yeah, it is. No question about it. I mean, we should have had some assurance if you had 60% of your units pre-sold that there's lots of money in the bank. But with these kind of costs, supply shortages and so on, so no fault of the developer, all of a sudden you're in a different world. It's a black swan.
Yeah, and we are in a different world, obviously, as we chronicle here on Money Talks. Ozzie, I'd invite people to go to ozbuzz.ca, ozbuzz.ca. And in the meantime, you go out and have a terrific week.
Thanks, Mike. And yes, we actually putting up the latest ozbuzz.ca on our website at ozbuzz.ca, where we have all of the details on the budget and the forecasts that we have. And Micah, just before I just got totally negative, we should mention this black swan on the positive side. It blew me away that we had 100,000 newcomers into British Columbia last year. Unbelievable number. 66,434,000 from inside the country. Now, if that were to be repeated today in 2022, that could mean 50,000 units for the first 100,000, another 50,000 units for the second 100,000 to either rent or buy. So we need a lot of accommodation, and that might just paper over any of our problems.
Well, I think it's also, though, a reflection of we don't have our policy isn't consistent. That, yes, I mean, I'm all for let's have some newcomers coming in, whether it's from another province, another country, et cetera. But our housing policy has to reflect that. And that takes, as we always say, three levels of government to get together on this. Otherwise, that upward pressure on rent, upward pressure on housing, you know, along with higher interest rates. Oh, that list just keeps going. And that's why we visit you every week, Ozzy. Have a great week.
Thanks, Mike. And remember, if you don't like where you are, move. You're not a tree.
Well, I thought I'd throw a curveball at Victor Adair. You know, come on, it's the Easter weekend. Victor, thanks for taking the time with us. But as I say, I got a curveball for you. I'm looking around, and you know, it's one of the sort of themes I've had is that we're at a historic level of change in so many different areas. And I think we're seeing it. But man, I just still can't believe the extremes that we're seeing. It doesn't matter if, you know, the, or maybe it's just the nature of the talk from the Federal Reserve, which is, of course, the big talk this week. But are you seeing the same thing out there? What are you seeing within the stage of all the futures contracts markets that you look at?
Well, you know, we can get so caught up in the short-term moves in the market because there's been some violent short-term moves, whether it's in crude oil, the stock market, what have you. But, you know, if you step back a bit, I'm asking myself, and maybe a long weekend is a good time to do this. I'm asking myself, are we in a new paradigm here? Have things changed that much that a lot of the metrics that we used to do to try to assess markets just don't apply? I mean, let me give you a couple of for instances. We've got CPI at a 40-year high. You know, the rate of change in the bond market, you know, yields have been going up faster than they've gone up in decades. We've got the Japanese yen at a 20-year low against the US dollar. You know, we've got the soaring volatility in these various markets. And I think to myself, you know, maybe it is a brave new world. Or the other thing as a trader would look at it, you say, no, it's never different this time. This is just, you know, we're reaching an extreme. It's showing up in different ways. Certainly it's showing up in sentiment and people's emotions. And as a trader, maybe you have to say, okay, we're setting up for some reversals here. It depends, obviously, very much on your time frame.
Well, let me just come to one of those things, Vic, is that I've been surprised when I look at the sentiment for the stock market being, you know, it's bearish. As I know you've noted on victoradair.ca, it's at a 30-year low. Well, I'm going, but the index doesn't actually reflect that. You know, shouldn't the market, if the sentiment's at a 30-year low, shouldn't the markets be a lot lower?
Well, that's the broad indices. I mean, on my blog, the last couple of weeks, I've been putting up charts of the Dow Jones transports, which has just been taken up behind the barn and shot, okay? You know, this is truckers, delivery services, airlines, railroads, that sort of thing. It's just been clobbered. You know, is it giving us a warning that, you know, the real economy, say, isn't as quite as great as people think? I mean, the sentiment is a reflection of there's bad news everywhere. We have a major war in Europe right now. You know, China has got 60 million plus people in lockdowns. There's a deglobalization happening. Interest rates are soaring. The Fed looks like they're going to take no prisoners. You know, there's a lot of things for people to be worried about. And the indices are near all-time highs. But as you and I both know, the internals of the stock market, we've seen a lot of sectors of the stock market have been clobbered here, certainly since, well, over the last many months.
Well, you certainly cheered me up because, of course, I'm aware of these factors, but I hadn't really sat down and put them all together in the way you just did. Oh, good, a food shortage. Like, yeah, starving people, that'll be good. Energy shortage. Oh, good, let's have rising energy prices. Oh, but that inflation is at a 40-year high, and that is just crushing. And a lot of people who say, hey, I can afford that extra gas price. I can afford the food costs. I don't like it, but I can afford it. Well, let's not forget about 40% of the population actually can't afford it. You're already forcing some major changes. So I look at this sort of list of things, and then how does that translate when you start looking for opportunities as a trader?
Well, there's kind of two things you can do in trading. You can go with the trend, or you can try to pick tops and bottoms. Let's say that. You know, I think I would like to be more of a go with the trend kind of a guy, because when that's working, boy, that works great. but there's also something in my personality where I like to pick tops and bottoms. Like when everybody's screaming, I want to, as they used to say on the floor in Chicago, when they're yelling, you should be selling. Okay. When people are begging their broker to get me into this market, you should be giving them all they want. So I'm kind of from that point of view. In terms of the food thing, I mean, we can go back to Malthus a few hundred years ago when he was predicting that there was going to be such a rate of increase in the population on the planet that we would all die of starvation because the planet couldn't support us. These Malthusian warnings have been out there, and they're probably got some substance to it. It has to have substance. We know fertilizer costs are up, fuel costs are up, the availability of food is likely to be lower. Some people are going to probably not get as much food as they'd like. But is it really going to be that extreme? There's the demand destruction, and then on the other side, there's substitution and there's innovation. We may find different ways to address these problems and find solutions. Let's say, paint me as a as an optimist on that front.
I was going to say you're a cockeyed optimist.
Okay.
There you go. Okay, Vic. Well, look, I know it's the Easter weekend. Go out and have a good time. But in the meantime, people can go to victoradair.ca, victoradair.ca. Look at his charts. You get the update on where Victor's coming from and wonderful facts. And as I say, the chart aspect, I think, is indispensable. So, Vic, have a great weekend.
Thanks, Mike. You too. And the best wishes to you and your family and all of our listeners for a great Easter weekend.
Time now for this week's Goofy Award. And I'm giving it to President Biden and his very confused administration. But you know what? I'm using them because people won't be so offended, because I could use it with some examples from Canada and other countries. Because there's so many leaders who fail to grasp the reality of an energy and food crisis. Let's start, though, with the absurdity of claiming that high oil prices are the result, in the president's word, caused by corporate greed, which completely ignores the reality of supply and demand, including the impact of sanctions slowing down the flow of Russian oil and gas. But to use his logic then, if this is because of corporate greed, these higher prices, how about this? The low prices from January 2016 to January 2021, I guess they're the result of corporate generosity. Next up, though, that's not all. Despite acknowledging the food crisis is real, and he's done that over the last few weeks, then the administration turns around and increases the amount of corn-based ethanol allowed in gasoline during the summer months. His goal is to lower gasoline prices because people will like that. Although he failed to mention, by the way, that the miles per gallon would be reduced too. But let's come back to adding more corn-based ethanol to gasoline. Food for gas tanks, not for people. Well, that wouldn't be much of a slogan for the midterm elections, would it? But it would be true. Sending the food into gas tanks? Come on, we've already got corn prices have skyrocketed this year, which has pushed the price of corn flour higher, any other food with corn as the ingredient. But here's the other thing. It's pushed costs for the livestock industry even higher. That's going to be reflected in higher meat prices. I mean, this is antithesis of saying, hey, we want to do something about the food crisis. They're making it worse. But here's arguably the big one. That's repeated, as I say, in many countries. But President Biden declared that oil companies, because of the high prices, aren't, in his words, in quotes, doing their part, because they're not increasing production. Instead, they are, in quotes, choosing to make extraordinary profits without making additional investment with supply, end of quote. So yeah, they want to have more supply. But think about this. Just a month ago, his same administration asked Congress to institute new fees on federal oil and gas leases that have previously agreed upon costs, but he wanted to force firms to drill. How about this? The same Democrats that are calling for a windfall tax on oil companies because they're, in quotes, ripping off Americans, but he wants them to increase supply? Less than 2 weeks ago, they forced oil company executives to appear before the Energy and Commerce Committee, who accused them of price gouging. Come on, is it any wonder that the industry doesn't trust politicians, at least some of them? They want them to spend big capital investment to up production. But they're worried they're going to be back to being vilified by the political class as soon as this immediate crisis is over, which, of course, then jeopardizes their new investments. They're not making investments for the next 2 weeks or even 2 years. These are longer term investments. Well, I think simply put, they don't trust the political class. And why should they? Look at the contrary kind of verbiage being used or directed at them. They're called greedy. They're called ripoff artists. You know, they're being called to account. That is not how you encourage more production. I mean, who in their right mind would trust these grandstanding politicians? Well, certainly not the major investors needed to significantly increase production. You know what? So they probably won't. Well, that's it for this week. I hope you have a wonderful Easter weekend there. Get a chance to just relax, enjoy family, etc. And in the meantime, we'll talk to you next week.
This is the Money Talks podcast with Michael Campbell, available at mikesmoneytalks.ca or through your favorite podcast subscription service. Join us on Facebook at Michael Campbell's Money Talks and on Twitter at Money Talks Tweet.